Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting today with first-time guest here on the program, Professor Jonathan Kirshner. The professor has written a book titled American Power After the Financial Crisis, and we have been chatting with him about the root causes of the financial crisis. And given, Jonathan, that you had really pointed out that one of the causes of the crisis was the massive amount of derivative exposure that these too big to fail banks had, and given that by at least some of the research I've done that derivative exposure really hasn't gone away in spite of some additional regulation. In fact, by some accounts, it's actually larger than it was prior to the financial crisis. What would be your prediction as to the future of the U.S. banking system? Are we going to see a repeat of what happened back in 2007-2008?
Well, I'm wary of making point predictions, and I would also urge your listeners to be wary of those who would make them. But I would say the following, and it is ominous, but I think it is true, which is that the underlying causes of the global financial crisis of 2007-2008, in the United States at least, have not gone away. That we still have financial institutions that are too large, too interconnected, and take on or generate too much systemic risk, even in the light of the reforms that we have seen in the wake of the crisis. I think those reforms overall, while some of them are real, have been in aggregate fairly modest. And there are two interesting reasons for that, I think. One is that people complain about the way the government responded to the crisis, but in fact, we stood on the brink of another Great Depression. And government policy, however imperfect, flooding the system with liquidity and an early bout of countercyclical lending, prevented the Great Recession from becoming the Great Depression. We were kind of fortunate, however tragic that is to say, to have only experienced the Great Recession and not the Great Depression. But that inhibited fundamental reform of the banking sector. In the Great Depression, because it was so horrible, we did get fundamental reform of the banking sector. Here, we got marginal change at the edges. We also need to understand that our financial sector is enormously powerful, and they spent hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying Congress when those new regulations were being written. So obviously, if they're, you know, as smart as they think they are, those hundreds of millions of dollars were money well spent, and those were designed to protect their what they perceived to be their narrow business interests from the heavy hand of government, but which left the rest of us still vulnerable to the systemic risks that their activities generate. So while I would not predict a financial crisis, I would say that the U.S. financial economy remains vulnerable to the possibility of financial crisis, pretty much for the same reasons why it was vulnerable to financial crisis leading up to 2007-2008.
Well, Jonathan, let me get your take on monetary policy. You'd made a comment that one of the policy responses of the Fed was to flood the economy with liquidity or cash through the quantitative easing programs. Now you see that Europe has really engaged in a similar program. Japan has been printing at a maniacal pace for a long time. And worldwide, we seem to have this race to the bottom as far as currency devaluation is concerned. Give me your take on what the end game is. How does all this play out? And what are the political ramifications of this policy?
Sure. In the U.S., eventually these activities will be unwound. I'm not one of those who is terribly alarmed about the threat of high levels of inflation coming on the heels of this quantitative easing. I think it was necessary. It perhaps was overly necessary because of a bit of fiscal paralysis in other branches of our government, and so monetary policy perhaps was asked to do more than it really was designed to do. But the risks of deflation in the U.S., Japan, and Europe continue to outweigh the risks of inflation. And, you know, given the history of the Fed, it is very doubtful that if and when inflation does appear to rear its head, the Fed will not take rather prompt measures to reel it in. And the Fed is well disposed to be able to do that. So I do think those emergency measures were absolutely necessary. I think that, you know, it's a simple counterfactual question. Had they not taken those measures, would the economy be worse off or better off? I think it would have been worse off. does the Fed have the capacity to unwind these measures? Yes, it does. But if anything, in the U.S., there needs to be a bit of caution about reeling these measures in too quickly because, as you observed, in much of the rest of the world, there is various styles of quantitative easing going on, and we will continue to see things like dollar appreciation, things that will cut against the competitiveness of our products as we try and sell them abroad. And so it's a very complex question. I do not fret that we're on the cusp of a hyperinflation due to quantitative easing, but it is something that will have to be managed properly.
So, you know, we have listeners that are tuning into the program every week, and they're managing money in 401ks and IRAs. And when you say that the Fed does have the ability to unwind these measures, could you comment on, one, some potential ways that the Fed does unwind these measures? And then secondly, how might some of our listeners managing their nest eggs be affected?
Well, I don't want to get too much into the technicalities of this because it's really not something that I feel certain about, that is the specifics of them. So speaking to the latter question, and again, not being someone who has a crystal ball about where the stock market is going, I would make the observation that part of the contribution to the massive bull market we've seen in the past few years is that these emergency financial measures have left few alternatives for investors to turn to other than equities, other than the stock market. And that as monetary policy in the coming years is likely to normalize, then that might undercut the momentum behind the racing bull market. It is, you would not think that people need reminding, yet they do, that markets can go both up and down. And so I think that the standard advice that most people give to investors remains true all the time, which is to diversify, which is to not expect super normal profits, and to and be defended against possible problems that would emerge. And so if your portfolio is diverse, and if your expectations are reasonable, and if you're alert to the types of risks that might be lurking in the economy, then you should be okay. I mean, this is not my area of expertise, but the stock market and historical perspective looks kind of high. I mean, that ought to be something that people calculate when they're thinking about equities. The problem is that bond yields are so tremendously low that it's hard for regular people to put their money in bonds and expect to kind of live off interest. That's just not a, that used to be a, something people could do in the real world, and it's harder now.
So, Jonathan, you had mentioned that one of the enemies, if you will, that the Fed was fighting when they implemented these emergency measures was deflation. And when you look at the recent CPI numbers, I think in January they were negative. Now, obviously, fuel prices have a lot to do with that, if not exclusively. But do you see, in your view, that the risks of deflation are still looming?
I do. Mostly because we're scraping near zero. We also in Europe and in Japan at the inflation rate, and if it goes negative, that just it puts you in a very new and dangerous world. There can be self-defeating dynamics of falling prices with regard to the generation of economic activity and with regard to the practice of monetary policy. The costs, people hate inflation, and I appreciate that, and I understand why. But to the real economy, the aggregate costs of very modest levels of inflation, say 3%, even 4%, economists cannot show them. They cannot say 3.5% inflation has this negative consequence on the aggregate real economy. I understand it erodes individual people's purchasing power, but from the perspective of real economic growth overall, you cannot say 3.5% inflation is a bad thing. Anything under zero, we know, is a bad thing. And a dangerous thing for the economy, and really can threaten economic growth. And so economic policymaking really needs to err on the side of a tiny bit more inflation than a tiny bit of negative inflation. And we are still in an environment where we're scraping too close to the risk of a deflationary environment. And we know for certain that is deleterious, and it can kind of wind down the economy in bad ways. Just look at the experience of Japan for the past 20 years. And so the onus of policy really needs to lean in the opposite direction. And I know that this is a very politically charged topic, and people, you know, shout hyperinflation from the rooftops. And it is certainly true that you cannot create economic activity by producing inflation. And that is not the point of the policy. The point of the policy is to make sure that monetary policy is not so restrictive that it's choking economic activity. So money cannot create action, and it will not. But the lack of money, too tight monetary policy, can be constricting of economic activity, and that can be dangerously consequential. So the question is, how do you orient your policy overall?
Jonathan, last question, the time we have left. With Europe now engaging in quantitative easing, with Japan having a very loose money policy, with the U.S. dollar now on a relative basis gaining significantly in strength, won't there be a lot of political pressure for the Fed to resume a quantitative easing program? And what do you think the Fed will do in light of that pressure?
I don't think so. My sense is that the weight of pressure on the Fed right now is more towards when will they peel back more of these quantitative easing measures? When will they start to raise interest rates? If you look at the minutes of the meetings of the Fed, the conversation seems to be tipping more in that direction. The main lever by which we will be negatively affected by the quantitative easing of others will be the exchange rate mechanism, the continued appreciation of the dollar. And if the Fed tightens money, the dollar will appreciate further still. In the U.S., because we have such a large domestic economy, that lever is not super direct. And so as the dollar appreciates, in the U.S. economy, dollar appreciation won't be super politicized. So I do think that it is possible that the quantitative easing of others and the general deflationary environment globally might take pressure off the Fed to act too promptly to back off quantitative easing and to raise interest rates aggressively. But I do think the tenor of the conversation, the thrust of political pressure that you see on the Fed in the current environment, is more towards get on with tightening. And it's not, I don't see the balance of pressure on the Fed towards loosening. That's, of course, I could be wrong, but I do think the struggle for the Fed will be resisting pressure to tighten too soon.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Professor Jonathan Kirshner. His book, American Power After the Financial Crisis, is something I would encourage you to check out and pick up. It's available at Amazon. And, Professor, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks to special guest this week, Mr. Jonathan Kirshner, for joining us. On Everything Financial Radio this week, we've been talking about the two-bucket approach. And it's an approach that we recommend that many folks take a look at and consider for managing their nest eggs. And we have been talking here on the Everything Financial Radio program about the difference between getting variable returns and fluctuating returns and more consistent returns. And of course, any discussion we have when we talk about what's happened in the past needs to be premised, or prefaced, I should say, with a statement that just because something happened in the past doesn't mean it's going to happen again in the future. Now, let's just take a look at this concept, and again, a little greater detail. Let's go back and look at the annual returns of the S&P 500 from calendar year 2000 through calendar year 2013. Now, speaking of average annual return, the average annual return of the S&P 500 over that time frame was 5.55%. Now, it's important to note that an investor cannot invest directly in the S&P 500. However, an investor can invest in a passively managed index fund that has the investment objective of duplicating the returns of the S&P 500. Now, just because a fund has that objective does not mean that that fund will actually achieve its objective. However, for this hypothetical discussion, let's assume you've got money in an index fund that's based on the S&P 500. And let's just assume the fund happens to return exactly what the S&P 500 index returns, as unlikely as that may be. Now, a $100,000 initial investment at the beginning of 2000 was worth at the end of 2013 163,961, and that's based on the average annual returns of the S&P 500, which ranged from a negative 37% in 2008 and a negative 22.1% in 2002 to as much as 32.39% return in 2013 and as much as 28.68% in 2003. So again, variable returns. Now let's contrast that with a 5.55% return every year on a consistent basis. A consistent return of 5.55% annually on a $100,000 beginning balance over the same time frame grows to $213,018. Comparing that to the average annual return of the S&P 500, which grew to only $163,961. So what's my point here? Well, given a choice between big potential for gains and consistency, many investors would be better served to seek consistency. This may become even more true for more investors as they get closer to needing to use the invested assets during retirement. Consistency is one of the five goals of the two-bucket management system. Now, if you're just tuning in, the five goals of the two-bucket management system, again, are to reduce fees associated with investments, limit or eliminate investment drawdown during a deflationary environment, limit losses, in other words, hedge for the possibility of inflation or even hyperinflation, hedge for the possibility of a future fiat currency failure, and achieve positive investment returns each year. And again, just because it's a goal of a particular strategy or methodology, that does not mean there's a guarantee the goal will be achieved. However, when you look at the two-bucket approach to managing assets, it's based in common sense, and it has a very simple premise. You just divide your assets into two separate buckets of money. Bucket number one is your deflation hedge bucket. It contains assets you'll need to meet your lifestyle needs during retirement. Bucket number two is your inflation hedge bucket. It should contain all your other assets. So in bucket number one, we're going to put assets that will tend to be more consistent, and in a deflationary environment, they will gain in purchasing power. Bucket number two is the bucket I'm going to rely on if we have significant inflation. And again, we can't predict policy response. Are we going to have inflation, or are we going to have inflation followed by deflation? Are we going to have go straight to deflation? The answer is yes, one of those will occur. Now the assets in bucket number one, which is the deflation bucket, should be invested conservatively, and the goal here is to achieve a predictable, consistent return. Now, assuming that outcome can be achieved, that approach will serve an investor well in a deflationary environment. A consistent, predictable return with no drawdown will gain purchasing power in a deflationary environment. Now, the assets in bucket number two should be invested to hedge against inflation, hyperinflation, or a fiat currency failure. We believe strict exit strategies should be used when managing bucket two assets in order to help protect from drawdown. And again, drawdown is what occurred in the stock market in 2001 and in 2008. It was a significant decline in the value of stocks. That's drawdown. Drawdown is defined as the price drop percentage from the peak to the trough. Avoiding drawdown is important and one of the big goals of bucket one assets. Now, the assets in bucket number one are paper money assets. The nice thing about paper money assets are that paper money assets gain purchasing power in a deflationary environment. When it comes to the assets in bucket number two, however, at least some of the assets should be real, tangible assets that are not the liability of another. This is a really important point. And a great question to ask yourself about your portfolio is, what assets do I have in my portfolio that are not the liability of someone else? See, the trouble, in my view, with the one-bucket approach advocated by many financial professionals using stocks and bonds or stock mutual funds and bond mutual funds only is that all the assets in the portfolio are paper assets. All these assets are the liability of another. And that brings me back to what I call an eternal economic truth. No central banker can change this truth. No politician can change this truth. Even with massive money printing, this truth cannot be changed. And here it is. If there's too much debt to be paid, not all the debt will be paid. It's as simple as that. If there's more debt than can be paid, then we know some of the debt will not be paid. It's that simple. And since we know there will be defaults on debt, which will result in a deflationary environment, it's important to ask ourselves this question. What assets in my portfolio are the liability of another? Or you could ask it another way. What assets in your portfolio are not the liability of another? Now, in my view, it's sad that in the case of many portfolios that I review, the answer is every asset in the portfolio is the liability of someone else. See, that's the nature of paper assets. See, while these assets are your assets, they're also the liability of another. When holding paper assets that are the liability of another, we want our counterparty to be as creditworthy as possible. Since we know not all the debt will be paid, but some of the debt will, if we're holding that debt or that paper asset in our portfolio, we want to be sure that we have a very high probability of getting repaid. Now, the reality is that the financial system under which we function uses paper assets that are the liability of another. So when it comes to selecting the assets in bucket number one, which are the assets you'll use during retirement, we have to use paper assets. We just want to make sure the counterparty, the person who owes us the money, the entity that owes us the money, the counterparty on these assets is creditworthy, so we minimize the risk of losing assets. Now, there are a number of different options for allocations in bucket number one and bucket number two, but it's important in our view that you understand the importance of using a two-bucket approach in light of these currency money cycles that exist and these economic cycles that exist. If you'd like to learn more about the two-bucket approach and how it may fit in with these currency money cycles and economic cycles, I'd like to invite you to get a free resource that we've made available. It's called the Investor's Discovery Kit. If you've not yet gotten it, it's easy to request. All you have to do is go to the website, investingapproach.com. Let us know where you'd like us to mail your Investor's Discovery Kit. So we just need a name and address. We will not follow up. We will not obligate you to anything. This is purely information. The website, again, investingapproach.com. Just visit there. Let us know where to mail your Investor's Discovery Kit. We'll send you a copy of the book, New Retirement Rules, as well as the New Economy magazine, as well as an educational CD and DVD, and that will be mailed out, and you'll have it in just a few days. So again, the website, investingapproach.com. That's our second podcast for the week. Hope you got something you can use. Talk to you again soon. Bye.